this morning on the subject of governance, an important aspect of governance. Before we introduce the speaker, however, I'd like to pay tribute to a great leader in the public administration field, John Macy. John Macy is head of the Civil Service Commission and is a leader in so many areas, was a hero to a great many of us, and we're very pleased that Mrs. Macy can be with us this morning. John Macy and Mrs. Macy visited the Miller Center 7 years ago.
Quite a while ago.
Yeah. So we're very happy to have you come back. Hope you'll come back many times. Good. Dr. Ronald Moe is one of those scholars who sticks to his knitting. He has an important area of interest. He has continued to pursue it. It is generally the area of government organization. That is an area which, however, is forever open to change and forces that put it in a different setting and context. He did his undergraduate work at Claremont College, his master's and PhD degree at Columbia University. He was born in San Diego, California. He has served since 1973 at the Congressional Research Service of the Library of Congress as the expert on government organization. The focus shifts within this very basic field, as he's pointed out in his writing, the emphasis on you have to keep him honest too, Mrs. Macy can't do everything. focus shifts in this important area from the emphasis in an earlier period, the 30s and the 40s, of public administration as a, quote, science, as some of its practitioners saw it, to far greater emphasis in later years on political and policy objectives. Dr. Moe has pointed out that we've had in the last half century three major presidential commissions, the Brownell Report in 37, the Hoover Report in 49, and the Ash Council Report in 1970, and they reflect changing emphases. In addition to his writing on the managerial presidency, the topic he's chosen for today, he's also written on the institutional vice president and on this rather peculiar problem of the inauguration, what he calls the second inauguration of vice presidents who become presidents. One could go on like this, but he can speak for himself far better than any of us can for him, and it's a great pleasure that he is willing to come down and make the long trek down and discuss the managerial presidency with us.
Thank you, Ken. I'm looking around this room. I almost want to put my notes away and talk about something else, but I'm not going to force myself to talk about a problem that we have. It's probably not one that you're that much aware of, but I think you will become aware of it by the time I'm finished. The title of my talk is The Managerial Presidency from Phoenix to Ashes. And if this title suggests that the managerial part of the president's portfolio is in disrepair, you're correct in that assumption. It should be pointed out right away that this opinion runs counter to the vast bulk of recent and current writing on the subject of the presidency, and indeed it probably runs counter to almost everyone you hear here. Many students today, all about them, when I say students, I mean you can be up in your 70s and be a student, contend that the presidency is strong and healthy and is in a commanding position in the political system, so that someone like James Sundquist can state the executive branch is equipped with a powerful executive office of the president that can offset parochial interests and try to arrive at a concept of the broader national interest. To a degree, the president is compelled to try because he's judged by the whole country on the basis of general conditions. And I just picked up the Political Science Quarterly yesterday, and there's an article by William West and Joe Cooper in it, and it states that in the contest between the Congress and the president, the president has been winning consistently. Terry Moe, who's no relation, is the principal proponent of the idea that the highly politicized White House and highly politicized OMB and agencies is not only natural but desirable, and it is the key to effective management. Rather than bemoan it and criticize it, he believes that politicalization is the key to contemporary government. Richard Nathan, another famous author on the presidency, argues for management by partisans. Quote, this concept is not appropriate but necessary to, not only appropriate, but necessary to a functioning democracy in a large and technologically advanced nation such as the United States. He argues also the principal thesis that he writes in his books is that the president really should ignore the lawmaking function and rule as much as possible by executive orders and administrative rules. I could go on and list all of the stellar stars of the establishment, and I'm suggesting basically they're all wrong. I'll open my remarks with a conclusion. The institutional presidency at the beginning of the 1990s is a less powerful institution, both absolutely and in relative terms, compared to Congress than it was a decade ago. In turn, the institutional presidency has been successively weaker after each decade since its peak during the last years of Eisenhower's administration in the 1950s. Increasing institutional weakness of the presidency has been most pronounced and most evident in the managerial responsibilities of the office. Indeed, today, the president is faced with an executive establishment that is in an advanced state of decline, disaggregation, and demoralization. It is an institution searching for a leader and for an organizational philosophy to replace the once authoritative administrative philosophy spelled out in the Brownlow and Hoover Commission report. Let me place this discouraging, albeit accurate, evaluation within a somewhat larger model of institutional politics and power in Washington. Institutional politics in the federal setting is best analyzed at three levels. The first level you have is the partisan level, and that's an important level. That's what you see in the newspaper every day. That involves people. That involves elections. Somebody's on top. Someone is behind. It's election-oriented. Personalities are what count. Ideas are only important as they help you to gain influence. Image and media are the coin of the realm. Substantive knowledge and experience are held suspect. The deal is the end in and of itself. The objective of this level of politics is to win elections. The second level is the policy level. Now, there are numerous policy systems at work in Washington and in Charlottesville, everywhere. In fact, most of us are parts of various policy systems. But when we are, let's say we're in the health field, we all know each other. In this field, we read the same journals. We're concerned essentially with the same problems. We use the same language. We go to the same meetings. You're all interested in policy here, I'm sure. The emphasis in policy level politics tends to be on concepts, although winning political battles is important. But the underlying all these social programs that we may be interested in are ideas. We want to know what poverty really is. For example, the aid for Families with Dependent Children program, AFDC, is a categorical grant program based on the notion of helping to keep the families together. The reasoning may be sound or false, as many argue that the FDC program is a principal cause for breaking up families. But the conflict, you see, is based over, in large part, on concepts rather than personalities. Thus, policy politics tends to take a longer view of issues, less dependent on personalities, and also is less visible to the public, because the objective at this second level is to influence or dominate policy decisions. Now, lots of times, someone will be in both levels. I mean, ideally, someone at the first level will see these various policy levels turning around. They try to go down, they pick one up, package it to sell it to the people, making it as simple as possible. And there's a third level, and that's the institutional level. Now, institutional politics is the least visible politics, but the players and the issues are, of course, are very important. The players here take the long view. The emphasis in that third level is on law and on regulations rather than on elections or policies. The politics is that of designing systems that create the capacity to govern and to build. This level of politics is interested in managerial issues and in subtleties. In many respects, it's nonpartisan politics, as the institutional approach is, for example, with regards to the presidency. People who are interested in the institutional presidency are concerned with certain types of issues and problems, not with who is the occupant at the moment. The objective in this third level is to determine the rules of the game. And our discussion this morning is going to be on this third level. Rarely do we really have a discussion of institutional politics. It is in the area of institutional politics where presidents can, if they're so disposed, really make their mark. This is where most management of the executive establishment occurs. And it is precisely in the realm of institutional politics where recent presidents have failed to develop their will and capacity to manage. Because presidents have not been adept players in the game of institutional politics, the initiative has shifted to Congress and to interest groups. By and large, presidents have permitted the Office of Management and Budget to drop out of the management business almost altogether. There's not a single person at OMB, and I absolutely guarantee this, who is responsible for organizational management. In fact, they eliminated that office in 1982. I'll tell you some stories about that in a little bit. So the OMB today is only concerned with financial management and support of budgetary priorities. And they have concentrated their rapidly diminishing resources on budgetary issues. The years since Watergate have been rough ones for the institution of presidency. We have numerous new laws, War Powers Act, and amendments to existing laws that work to limit the discretion of power of the president. Congress augmenting its institutional resources. It has substantial institutional resources. I remember back in the 50s and 60s when I was taking courses on the presidency, they were made fun of Congress. Congress couldn't be a modern institution because it didn't have the proper staffs, didn't have the proper information, didn't have the proper resources. I can assure you that is not the case today. We overwhelm the executive branch in these areas. Lloyd Cutler likes to point out, there is no institutional memory in the White House, and that is a fact. There is none. Insofar as the White House has memory, they have to call us up on the Hill. The decline of the presidency is because presidents are not interested in executive branch management. They weren't elected to do it, in their opinion, and they're not interested in it. So that the central managerial units, OMB, GSA, OPM, have all declined in terms of the quality and numbers of personnel, their authorities, and their political clout. Recent presidents have lacked a comprehensive managerial strategy upon assuming office. Only occasionally do they try to develop one while they're in office, and then usually with mixed results. Why have our recent presidents not taken the managerial responsibilities more seriously? Of course, there's 100 explanations, but let me briefly suggest my favorites. Presidents are not evaluated by the electorate for their managerial skills, and thus would-be presidents don't feel any particular need to concentrate on these skills. In their eyes, they're not elected to be managers. Now, I think they're incorrect in this perception. but they certainly believe it. Presidents and their staffs tend to bring political and policy perspective to their job. They were elected because they played and were winners in level one and level two. That's where the game is. They have a very short-term horizon. They're not interested in capacity building that will pay off for their successors, but not the incumbent. The White House staff has no institutional memory. It is closed up at the end of every presidency and essentially moved out. The people that presidents hire for the White House today, and have been since Kennedy's time, is pretty grim. By and large, are very young, inexperienced. Frequently, it's their first real job. It's almost pure on-the-job training. Everyone is held suspect out of the White House. By and large, presidents hire courtiers. Presidents tend to shy away from theory or doctrine. They pride themselves on being pragmatists. The motto is, if it works, it's probably right. They leave theory and doctrine to the Miller Center and other ivory tower types. This pragmatism tends to bring presidents into conflict with their public law responsibilities. Finally, presidents tend to view Congress, the career service, and the judiciary all as adversaries. Not since Eisenhower have we had a president who believed in management as institution building or in comity as the basis for good working relationship with Congress. Now, it's frequently asserted today that we cannot reasonably expect a president to be an active manager of the executive branch because the job is simply too big and complex for any one person to handle. The Constitution and the Take Care Clause does not permit, however, the president to opt out of his managerial role. The only choice a president really has is whether to be an effective manager or an ineffective manager, and most presidents have chosen to be ineffective managers. And the problem is that when you're ineffective, it becomes cumulative, and it's very difficult to regain the initiative. They find when they do enter management frustrating. Presidents want really to control agencies and what they're doing. But they're not prepared to exercise this control in any continuous or creative manner. They want power, but they're rarely interested in expending the resources and time to develop and systematize that power. What the problem is that they confuse control, of management as control rather than management as capacity building. And I believe that that is the root cause of the problem. If you look at the White House today, I mean, in the OMB and so forth, you will find, of course, that they're largely economists. And economists generally view things in terms of control. Bottom line, you look to see how the money's being spent. That's where you control things. Control a travel budget, and you'll determine how many cases the SEC can bring in New York. Control and keep the pay of the public sector down so that they cannot get good people. I mean, the truth of the matter, you are watching right today another cut in the core of the government as the government gradually declines in its capacity to perform fundamental functions at the center, and as more and more functions of the government are contracted out or put in quasi-governmental units, which very few people have control over, and we'll talk about that later. Presidents, however, have equated management with control, as I mentioned, and they seem to follow one or two or all five of five strategies, depending on where it is in their tenure. The first strategy is the use of the appointment power. And this is the emphasis on people. I've heard every time, this key is people. You have to have loyal people in all those key spots. It's control-oriented. At least initially, political appointees are interested in pleasing the White House, not the folks in the agency, but of course the White House always fears that they're going to go native. But the political appointee strategy is, in my opinion, generally minimally productive. It tends to politicize agencies which are not in the president's best interest to politicize. Politicizing the National Park Service is not, in my opinion, good politics, besides being poor administration. Often the best politics is no politics. Make some of the, instead of trying to concentrate the big issues under the rubric of the political appointees, Eisenhower used to spread it out and give them to the civil servants. That's a very, in my opinion, it's a very sophisticated strategy. You let them screw up, and then you send someone in. You say, I had nothing to do with it. It's that darn career service that messed this up. Then you send someone in. You always keep your distance. The president should keep the distance from the key problems of that type, only going in when it's absolutely necessary, instead of trying to bring him in the first instance into the political apparatus. Most political problems and scandals are caused by political appointees. Has it ever been interesting to you that almost all 99% are caused by these loyalists? Why? Because they bring the ethics of the private sector to the public sector. They're always confused that they can't go to lunch or make telephone calls, and they almost always get in trouble. The second strategy that presidents have used for control purposes is structural reorganization. And we've done this for a long time. It goes back to the progressive movement and the one way, there's the belief that there's one way, best way of organizing an agency or program, sort of scientific management. For many years, presidents liked reorganizing agencies. It gave the appearance of action. And of course, you had the Brownlow, Hoover, and the Ash Council. Now, I don't want to, I've written on all three of these, and I do not want to get romantic about them. I think it's dangerous. But anyway, they at least had a public law basis in their arguments. They generally called for fewer departments, fewer agencies, and greater accountability. But since 1971, and you can document this, we have literally moved completely away from what is known as the orthodox theory of management, as expounded by those three commission reports. If you were to ask anybody in the White House, even any of those three names, of course, they would have no idea who they were. There is no memory of any of them except on the Hill, where it's romantic. But the truth of the matter is that we have lots of reorganization going on today, but it's all disaggregation. The centrifugal tendencies of interest groups and of the agencies themselves trying to protect themselves from going under, trying to retain a few competent personnel because the government is basically an employer of last resort, against OMB, which OMB is attempting to keep them under control but not giving them the resources to do their job. They're not part of the problem. They're part of the problem, not part of the solution. The proliferation of agencies is extraordinary, and most particularly in the Twilight Zone, which is my job to keep track of the creation of quasi-governmental institutions, which pay high salaries and perform various functions they ought not be doing. A third strategy that presidents use for control purposes is the administrative strategy. I mentioned that Richard Nathan is a big proponent of this. What happened was, in 1969, when Nixon came into office, he was a believer in orthodox theory of administration. And he did have the Ash Council, which proposed an orthodox set of proposals to have four large domestic departments, as you recall, and then have seven departments made into four. But most importantly, his theory was this, that you would have within like a Department of Natural Resources, you would have the energy folks and you would have the conservation folks and environmental folks all in one agency, so that the first level of compromise would be within that department rather than with the budget examiner. That was the whole idea. Had a lot of other proposals. You remember revenue sharing and a lot of, it was a very sophisticated, we could certainly criticize parts of it, but it was a consistent, systematic whole proposal he made to Congress. He actually put up a lot of his political clout into it, and the liberals didn't buy it, and neither did Congress, and indeed they criticized him. And one of the things that really bothered Nixon was he was the first one, the Ash Council recommended before they even submitted his recommendations to Congress, that they count correctly the number of people who were employed in the White House. So for the first time, he counted them correctly, and then the papers took it up that he had doubled the size of the White House, and he says, this is what happens when you're honest. Every time you public administrators tell me to be honest, look what happens to me. He's never gotten over, I mean, you know, his presidency, he's never gotten over this misstatement of fact, which many of our own people used against him. Because he was so badly defeated in this area, and since he could see no advantage, find no advantage to it, people began to tell him, do it, do as much as you can by executive order. Ignore the normal system. The newspapers are against you. Everybody's against you. Start going your own way. So he began to impound funds, you remember? Because Harry Truman had impounded funds and no one complained. He was considered a great man for doing it. That was awful stupid congressman. Nixon did it, he was evil. But he did these various activities to avoid the normal legislative route, which he had found to be frustrating. So I would contend that's a very bad strategy to follow, as indeed what occurred was is that Congress reacted. Most famous reaction was the 1974 Budget and Impoundment Act, created both a congressional budget, because when you started misusing OMB, and so no one took the figures that they sent up seriously anymore. And so Congress began to make its own figures. Now we have the worst of all worlds. We have two budgets and no one's responsible. Lou Fisher and I believe we shouldn't have a congressional budget or congressional budget office. They don't like us for saying that, but I would like to restore the president responsibility for sending up these statistics that he is personally responsible for on projections, rather than automatically having two sets of projections and then splitting down the middle, which is the sophistication we go to in analyzing what is going to happen. I mean, the War Powers Act and all kinds of amendments you're not familiar with were all designed to decrease the discretion of the president, but if you went back, in every case there was a good reason why Congress did it. The fourth strategy is a financial control strategy. There's where you use the budget to control the bureaucracy. This is the way economists do it. Economists run OMB, and presidents have bought into their model. You control by cutting down the resources available to the agencies. I would argue, but in some respects, this makes us more creative. We are now coming up with user fees and asset sales, and we're coming up with creative ways in which more and more agencies are learning how to pay for their own activities, and I can give you lots of interesting examples in this regard. Well, however, when you have an agency that truly is on its own, that is, it is revenue sufficient, you also and take it out of the appropriations process, which is the ideal for many of these people, you also lose the leverage for oversight in large measure by the president and by Congress. So when you allow user fees to replace appropriated funds, it's not without its political cost. But we are moving very rapidly in this direction, as are all nations of the world. And finally, we have process management strategy for control. Remember how presidents are always interested in controlling without people, with Ma no hands. We get PBBS systems, we get management by objectives, we get zero-based budgeting. All these are designed, presumably, to bring forth information that wasn't previously available. It never does. It also, you're supposed to do it with very few people, and it's supposed to be sort of apolitical. Well, each of these exercises basically has been unsuccessful after exerting considerable cost. Now, none of these approaches is all wrong. They all have their useful attributes. But presidents are poorly advised if they're looking for shortcuts in management. The basis of management of government always has been, and always will be, the quality of the public laws that are passed and are implemented. To ignore this truth is the court disaster, and we have been ignoring this truth. The laws of the United States have become increasingly, not only are they lacking conceptual clarity, but they are just becoming unbelievably long. And we'll talk a little bit about this too, maybe. So then, in other words, everybody's, there is no central place anymore that the president has the ability to control laws. We used to have something called central legislative review. And all the bills that were going up and all the testimony and so forth was supposed to go through OMB. Well, it does on a pro forma basis, but that office now has been delegated so far down. I doubt whether Darman has ever met the head of his Office of Legislative Review. At one time, that was the key. In other words, you couldn't go up and propose the creation of a new agency or new government corporation unless its organizational aspects were designed by OMB. You started off from there. And Congress works well when the OMB has its act in line and sends up a coherent, legally sound bill, and then Congress can play around the edges to make it politically palatable. That's what Congress does best. But when Congress, which means its subcommittee staff, all none of whom are over 30, are charged with coming up with the design of the Uranium Enrichment Corporation, which I've been working on, and they have no idea, well, you can look at it, I can guarantee you it will never work. Okay? They create boards where they shouldn't be boards, they have it incorrectly funded, it goes on and on. And that is because OMB plays no role whatsoever, has no capacity more to play a role in designing systems. Now, we're not talking about small stuff, we're talking about the heart of our country. The executive branch is rapidly disaggregating. Increasingly, functions are being assigned to units at the fringe of the executive branch, and even to units outside the executive branch altogether. The central managerial agencies are increasingly denied authority to keep central review of policies and operations. Most studies of organizations have recommended decentralized and flexible administrative practices, hiring systems and accounting systems. But a retention of central policy and program oversight is critical. That doesn't mean you get down into operations, but OPMs, for example, should have responsibility for personnel systems. OPM only has responsible for 60% of the federal employees. The other 40% are under wide variety and increasing number of individualized personnel systems, which compete with one another for the remaining stock personnel. Presidents, therefore, should have something near them, preferably, I'll explain where it ought to be in a minute, that watches over the whole picture of federal employees, not just little OPM's general schedule group, which is the least creative aspect of our employment anyway. So what we have in Harold Seidman's phrase is rapid growth of quasi-government. We are blurring the distinction between what is public and a private. Now, you can bring down 50 professors who will tell you not only is this creative management the new wave of the future, you have to have a complex response to a complex situation. Wrong. Wrong. You can have simple and intelligent responses to complex situations. I argue you do not mix in any equity basis the public and the private sector. You say, well, I don't understand that. Well, look at the situation with Fannie Mae. Okay? Fannie Mae is a government-sponsored enterprise created to do good things, right? Every time you see someone say, I want to do a good thing, be wary. I always challenge my graduate students to state me one program that you're willing to defend that's really worked, and you're always hard-pressed. The truth of the matter is that program was based on the notion everyone should own a home. That's a questionable public policy objective anyway, and they should own it with virtually no risk, very little down, so they can walk away with it. Then you give benefits to banks and others to make these high-risk loans. And all of this, of course, is taken over by the taxpayers. What you do is you create systems in which at no point in the system is a risk taken by the person who's going to benefit. When we design these systems and we have them all over, we're surprised at the results. Who's at fault? We are in the public sector. Okay? We don't even have a theory that will tell anybody what should be done privately and what should be done publicly, much less any theory about how to design it so that it can protect the public interest. We have no theory. There isn't a single course taught in the United States today that talks about third-party government, a government by contractors, or how to manage contractors. We're still teaching hierarchical courses, how to motivate people for whom you give commands to. But most of the operations of government today are not command mode operations, they're negotiations. It's a negotiation mode. I know people, if you go to AID, for example, there'll be one AID person who's running all of East Africa, and all of the activities done are by contractors out there. Now the travel budget is such that this person is a friend of mine, has never visited any of the six countries that they have control of because they're not allowed out of the country. But the contractors are. The only way they can manage what's going on in Somalia, which is a mess, is through negotiations management, of which there is no theory and we don't even bother to teach it. But if you ask anybody in the real live government, you say, what do you do? And most of them will say, I manage contractors. Not very exciting work, I might add. What we have here then is our best activities are being assigned to third parties. In order to combat the such things as a decline in government, we now go into ad hoc legislation. The FBI hardly functions at all. If you're a toll taker going into New York City, you make more than the top FBI agent in New York City. They can't get anybody to work there. So they passed a special law giving those who work in New York City a $20,000 a year bonus. No bonus for Chicago and New York, either. I have just New York. Right. Means that the guy in New York now makes as much as the Attorney General. Okay. We got a mess. And when we get out of this situation up in Andrews, and they're going to, if they do not allow locality pay in this next pay bill, every agency of government is going to seek its way out. And if you think I'm exaggerating, I was at the National Academy of Public Administration yesterday, and we are putting on a program called Alternative Personnel Systems, Antidote or Fragmentation. Now, this program, if you know how to read these kinds of things, it will say, should agencies continue to work under Title V of the U.S. Code or not? That sounds innocuous enough. But what that really is saying is that the basis of government is Title V of the United States Code. There's a phrase in it that says all agencies of government are under all of the United States Code except where there's an exclusion in their Enabling Act. So all of the laws of the United States government having to do with personnel, finances, all the complex generic management laws, all are in the code. Now the key of this is that then you have politics of exceptions. The politics is trying to get an exception from the code rather than having to recreate the code every time you pass a new agency. What this is designed to do is have those agencies that have successfully gotten out from under Title V, which allows them, therefore, to have their own personnel system, their own pay, their own way of hiring and firing people, okay? To tell those agencies that need to get out, if they're going to continue functioning, how to do it. I mean, it's a pretty expensive course, but it includes a Deputy Assistant Comptroller General, the General Accounting Office. I mean, we're not talking, these people are saying, you guys want to continue in business, you're going to have to get out from under OMB and you're going to have to get out from under Congress. Now, how do we combat that? Do we even want to? Most of the people I know say, Ron, you are literally the only person in the United States government who is still arguing for a total accountable system under the president. Presidents have failed, the system has failed, and you're the last guy still arguing for it. Well, I still will. How do you do it? You do it through generic laws. I don't know if you've ever heard that phrase. But a generic law, I also got the last PhD in the United States in the field of public law. Can you believe it? The year after I got it, they stopped the program. You see, there's a difference between public law and private law. Private law is what you learn in law school. Tort law. Public law is what political science started off at. I went to Columbia, the very first degree in the United States. PhD was started in Columbia. It was law and public law and government. The word political science originally meant social science. So there was a school of political science, which included history and all that, and public law was a subfield, and private law was another subfield. But after World War I, we switched our titles, and so it became as political science became the title, and social science became the word, and law got shoved off to the professional schools. The secret of running a large operation like the government is to have good generic laws. I'll give you some examples. We have 100 to 150, depending on how you define them. an example of a generic law would be the Government Corporation Control Act, which sets up standards by which have to be met in the accounting and the auditing standards and in their revenue, the way they gather revenue, and other technical matters are all established in the Government Corporation Control Act. And if you want to have a government corporation, which is a very useful device, the FAA, for example, should be a government corporation. It raises revenues in excess of expenditures, but it still comes under appropriations. That's why we have problems with regular appropriation. They have a trust fund, but can only be taken from by appropriations. It isn't one that they can draw upon for their needs. If we just change those two words in the law, we'd solve that problem. Now, but you have these generic laws. Now, the problem is, and then if some particular government corporation, like Federal Prison Industries, which is a very lucrative corporation, shouldn't be under some of the same rules for accounting purposes as the Tennessee Valley Authority, they can get an exception. But people in the Hill and downtown can cope with the politics of exceptions if they know what the general rules are. We all intelligently can sit around a table and discuss whether the burden of proof is being met by those asking for an exception. But what we can't cope with is a vast field in which there is no generic law. The problem with the Government Corporation Control Act is not that it isn't a good act, it's just in the last 20 corporations we created, we didn't put them under the Government Corporation Control Act. This is why the Legal Services Corporation is always in trouble. Okay? Always in trouble, and always will be in trouble. We have other generic acts. You remember, you probably, most of you have been in government, I suppose you remember the Anti-Deficiency Act. There's a good example of one, an Anti-Deficiency Act. Remember how agencies would get all of their annual appropriations in a lump sum, and then voila, they'd all be spent out by the 10th month, and they'd have to come up for a supplemental, and it became a game. You get the Anti-Deficiency Act, you only get your money in quarterly amount. If you're deficient one quarter, you have to make it up in the next quarter, and this keeps down the number of supplementals. However, agencies that are not really agencies of the United States, that is, if they say this agency shall not come under the Title V, and its employees shall not be considered employees of the United States, they don't come under the Anti-Deficiency Act, just for an example. Now, what happens when you don't come under the Anti-Deficiency Act, like the Smithsonian Institution and other problem institutions? They get all their money at one time, okay? They can't use it all at one time, so they put it into private bank accounts. Briggs National Bank, to be specific, okay? Now, the money that they receive in interest from it, they claim isn't government money, and they are not accountable to how it is spent. And you can rest assured, and this occurs as sure as anything, that that money will be spent on something they know Congress wouldn't approve of. Okay? That's why they're always in trouble. I argue that these generic acts should always apply, and the burden of proof should be on those who... Now, it happens that after several scandals, Congress had passed a specific law to put the Legal Services Corporation under the Anti-Deficiency Act, which is the only act that is related to OMB. Otherwise, OMB has no control over it. These generic management acts taken together provide a framework within which a president can, if he so disposed, shape the direction of the management of the federal government. These laws provide the legal basis for implementing a management strategy. We once had one, we no longer have one. The president's first line of management are the quality of the generic management laws. I wrote an article on this savings and loan bailout bill. It has a long title. We could sit around this room. It's the longest bill ever passed in United States history. OMB played no role in it. It is the worst single law in the history of the United States without question. No one would even begin to approach this for unmanageability. Okay? And you could sit around this room right here and you haven't had any experience in it, and we could design a better bill than was designed after a year and a half. Anyone could design a better bill. And that's our generic act. Presidents and Congress like to pass narrow little acts. Prompt Payment Act, Federal Managers Financial Integrity Act, because they assume federal managers don't have integrity, they have to pass a special act. they put stuff in laws that would not pass on their own merits. Minority set-asides, which are a source of unbelievable scandals, Buy America legislation, etc. Federal program managers in this new environment have become, as you would, become risk-averse. They know that they're only rewarded for spending money on time and getting it to the right people. The results of the program are not what you're rewarded for. You can only get in trouble. You can never be benefited. Presidents have found frequently to their chagrin that whole fields of public policy have slipped from their grasp. Many of the important decisions today are made by third parties. Managers today are increasingly contract writers and supervisors with little direct control or responsibilities for programs. That's the problem with NASA. Horror stories abound where the government has literally become captive of third parties. This is a story of the Department of Energy. I was at a meeting about 3 years ago, but this bill still hasn't passed yet, so it's still around, but because someone wanted to create and reorganize Uranium Enrichment Corporation. Now, I don't understand the fine points, and one doesn't need to understand how you enrich uranium, but we at one time had a monopoly on it, but we didn't make it a government corporation so that there was no new capital in it, and of course the rest of the world passed us up. So instead of being 100% exporter, I mean, we export whatever we didn't use, we now are importer of it. And the question is, do we care? Do we want care? And some people say, well, we ought to care. And so they come up with the idea, why don't we create a new corporation? Well, I won't go into that, but let me say this, we had a meeting. And as I say, this was mostly done by subcommittee staff who are very young, very bright, but very young, and do not know there's such a thing as the Government Corporation Control Act or anything like that because they weren't trained that way. And then as we sit down, and what we thought were the DOE representatives of the Department of Energy. But about halfway into it, it was finally recognized that we were discussing this with Martin Marietta. Martin Marietta has been contracted to do the negotiations with Congress on this issue. The Department of Energy no longer has the personnel or capacity to perform basic negotiation functions. Two of us got up and left. I do not believe in conducting government discussions with private corporations. You think there was such a thing called the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. They kept the personnel of that so low that at its peak, it had 143 people, including janitors. Everything that the FSLIC did was by contract. Had over $280 million of contract with law firms in Washington, D.C. Now let me ask you, you can guess what the incentive structure of a law firm in D.C. is. Is it to resolve the case or to have it at $200 an hour go on as long as possible? Is it any wonder that our cases were never resolved in this area? Because we do not allow hiring of in-house lawyers at competitive pay at all, who would be rewarded for resolving that case. What we have done is we've taken this fundamental function and given it to local law firms, and I have friends who do it. That'd be the time I could illustrate the points I've been making thus far with details and case studies. These case studies would have probably included the subject of government-sponsored enterprises, which are Fannie Mae, where the line between the public and the private sectors have been deliberately blurred. Where we have private corporations operate with the full faith and credit of the United States Treasury. Given the situation as it is today, what should a president do to reassert his managerial authority and responsibilities? Well, first I would suggest that he should recognize that there is a problem. If you went to the White House today and you asked John Sununu, is there a problem? He'd say things have never been managed better. You have them around the table. I'm sure that you get all these people all the time. Right? In fact, they want to cut the size of the executive office. The interesting thing is that presidents really are judged more by their managerial capacities than almost anything, in my opinion, politically speaking. I mean, what killed Jimmy Carter? is that he was perceived to be managerially incompetent.
A correct perception.
He was genuinely an incompetent person, okay? And that's killed him. Because once a president is perceived to be less competent than the person who is perceiving them, if I could do a better job than that president's dead. Presidents should recognize that the executive establishment is a resource to help them achieve their overall strategy of governance. Generally, to function with obsolete equipment, contract operators, overworked staff, and high turnover. Government management strategy would be designed to make the United States government a good employer. This government is a miserable employer. Good management strategy would recognize that the budget is a basic tool for creative management, not for control. Presidents must resist the practice of disinvesting in government. The government need not be more interventionist in the economic realm. I'm a free marketeer, so I'm not interested in becoming more bigger. But its fundamental tasks have to be performed extremely well. And they are. The SEC, for example, should not be cut in size and quality. There's a greater need for enforcement today than in the past, not less. And the reason is, and this is a very subtle point, but I believe is the issue of the 90s, and the reason why America's in real trouble. We have international competition all over the world, and all of our investment decisions, mine included, can be made from a computer by having that transaction done in Zurich or unless the United States can guarantee that it has an honest system in which the government is not penalizing the people performing market transactions in the United States, the business will go elsewhere. And it's very simple, and the loss can become irretrievable. The SEC today is a miniature operation. Run essentially by missionaries, and can hardly bring any cases. The president's third should reorganize the executive office of the president. I don't mean to make it more political. It doesn't have any institutional memory and therefore no staying power on issues. The personnel are too specialized, but usually the specializations are political. I mean, you go in the Secretary of the Cabinet today. We once had a Secretary of the Cabinet, and that person was in there for a while. Some presidents have, some don't. You probably even talked to them. They used to actually organize the agenda, do follow-up action, they actually did substance. The current one puts name tags on the table. In other words, they have the position. It's time that they get some mature people in to do mature work. I would suggest the following proposal, that we should recognize that OMB has failed and it should be split between an Office of Budget and an Office of Federal Management. Budget priorities always drive out management priorities. This experiment has failed. You will be told that the management should tag along with the budget because the budget gives it clout. False. No evidence that that's the case. All we do know for absolutely sure is budget people don't care about management. They care about something else. What we need is a separate Office of Federal Management, which would be in charge of developing of these generic laws and enforcing them. They would be the management agent of the president. OFM's authority would extend across the government. It would be able to promulgate the executive orders and enforce them. It would not be so much a top-down agency as OMB is today, but a catalyst to permit agency and program managers to do their job better. It would be oriented towards capacity building rather than control. Ideally, OFM ideally would have the president's commitment and necessary staff resources. My belief would take approximately 200 persons, and I could practically give them, each of them would be in charge of various laws, and you could design this thing fairly easy. I mean, I work on the Congressional Research Service, and we have over 400 analysts, and we are all specialists in our areas. And I'm the only one around who was here when the Ash Council was under consideration. I mean, I can tell you the people in OMB do not remember, though. Remember it, and there's no one downtown who does. And that's wrong. If we're going to expect the president to meet the challenges of this coming century, he's going to need institutional support, and he's going to need it in the form of an office of federal management. Just, I'll finish up with some of the, a couple of the functions of this office, you know. Should handle government organization matters. These no longer should be left to the agencies and departments and corporations and enterprises who do their own designing. I mean, you have, they have a massive conflict of interest. All this should be done with OFM approval. Procurement policies and management. They shouldn't get into the details, but the general principles and practices should be handled out of an Office of Federal Management. Workforce management. You know, I mean, much of this workforce is not under OPM, as I've mentioned. SES pay is, and the whole concept that SES doesn't apply throughout the government, doesn't apply in my agency. It hasn't worked very well, and that's certainly not met its hoped for aspirations. FEI is still down here in Charlotte. That's a highly debatable issue. Major workforce problems require broadest presidential perspective, and we certainly don't have them. We have no plan for the workforce of the year 2010. This agency should handle financial management systems. We should have common accounting systems, whether they're compatible. What has happened is this GAO, the legislative branch, is doing it insofar as it's done. Regulatory review processes. We have a lot of regulatory review processes going on, and that's what it should be going on in the Office of Federal Management. Government capital investment policies and practices should be handled with a broad view, not just by the departments. Reports, statistics, and publications policies require central review from a presidential perspective. If we don't have it, what we get is what they don't like, which they call congressional micromanagement. But I guarantee you can go to almost every issue, you will find that it is not Congress going out wanting to get involved in this. It's because nobody is doing it. And then Congress gets down into the details. I'll give you one final kind of detail that's interesting to me about how. For years, everyone talked about the federal retirement system. How many of you are on the federal retirement system? Any of you on it? And that was a defined benefit plan, not a defined contribution plan. And it had an unfunded liability that was variously estimated between $800 billion and $3 trillion. I mean, you know, nobody knew what it was. Furthermore, nobody cared. But there was one thing everybody agreed upon. There was nothing you could do about it. So the same people that I criticized for wanting to control the government did come up with ideas, that is the public, sort of the public choice type people on the congressional committees, basically, although there was some work downtown on it, but really it was done in the Government Operations Committee, to come up with a defined contribution system for federal retirement. And the impossible happened. It passed. And it's a pretty good system. And I joined it, even though, statistically speaking, they said I shouldn't. I said, I've been arguing this thing for all these years, I have to join it. And it's already benefiting me because now I can leave the government along with all my colleagues as quickly as possible. But they have, what it did though, is that it has the two incredibly important things. First of all, you are no longer tied to the government. In other words, you contribute, the government contributes, it's a real live money. It is not an unfunded obligation of the government. You can take it out after 3 years or 5 years, and you lose nothing. There's no longer the golden noose. What it's done, it has integrated the federal workforce into the national workforce and vice versa. And this is a dramatic change that hasn't been studied. Okay? No one any longer has to stay in the government. We don't know how to compete for people that we, you know, to fill the positions at mid-level and higher that we lose. Because government's never done it. It just kept those same people on. Right? We don't know how to do it. But anyway, we now have an integrated national workforce. And secondly, we are doing away with that unfunded obligation. The impossible is happening. In 20 years, there'll be no unfunded obligation. We will have a self-sufficient and self-funded and respectable retirement system. Now, I argue we do the same thing with Social Security. It's also an impossible idea that will occur at some point, okay? And what I'm saying is this is a time not to get too despondent, although I get very upset at this organizational situation. This is a very creative time. Other countries are being incredibly creative. It's really shocking when you go to international meetings and realize how advanced they are compared to us in many areas. And we are in, so this is what I suggest to people, that we view our system, our public and private system, no longer as two separate systems, although legally they should remain separate, but conceptually we should think of them as a whole and realize that international competition is equally between our public sector and someone else's public sector, how well they regulate in England or not regulate, or Japan, and our private sector. So in other words, our competitive position has to be viewed systemically and not just as competition between private sectors. I believe that's sort of the reason that our president's managerial situation has declined, deteriorated, except in foreign affairs, and occasionally when a president can get excited about it, he can still, on any given issue, be a leader. But in the day-to-day management, we have allowed it to decline. And I think it has to begin at institutes like this, have to become upset and encourage people to write about it and get that problem out quickly. And then maybe we will face up to it and work at it.
I would like to ask the first question. Ron Moe has thrown down the gauntlet to some of you. Bill, Frank Elliott, okay.
Well, I'll take a look. You're as cynical as I am, Ron, after all those years. My question, the effort to change at the time the Ash Commission came along, what do you think the merits of it were? And two, what do you think the practical politics were that inhibited from being put in place?
Well, first of all, I do not want to be perceived as being cynical about this. If one brings up the problem, and I've suggested the solution, then it's doable. Okay? And I've also suggested that in many areas where people were cynical, that by using our brains, okay, and being sophisticated about it, we are able to solve them. So I believe all these problems are essentially soluble. And I believe they're soluble conceptually through generic laws. So... Well, whenever a proposal is brought up by a president, I don't care what it is, and the Congress is controlled by the opposite party, you got a lot of problems. I mean, I don't know. It was, in my opinion, it was a conceptually sound approach to administration. It represented the final thrust of the old orthodox progressive view, which I happen to agree with, which is what in our little business, I'm the one, when they say, well, there's another position, and I'm the only one that's cited in favor of that. That is sound, because the alternative is that the people who make fun of that is the hierarchical model, have never proposed anything better. And in the absence of anything better, you've got a real problem, because I would argue, well, then it isn't enough merely to say that having all these agencies accountable to the president is unrealistic and they defeat it. They have no alternative other than disaggregation, which is what we do. I mean, our policy today is disaggregation. It's just an implicit policy. But each agency wants its own personnel system. Each agency wants its own financial system. OMB does not have a conceptual argument to fight against it. So the Ash Council sort of was the last gasp of the orthodox school, and it was badly defeated. The liberals didn't like it because it was proposed by conservatives, and that killed it. If they had proposed it, they would have liked it. I mean, I don't mean that. I'm not being cynical. I mean, they went in there without really a chance of any of that ever flying. Also, it was pretty dramatic stuff. I mean, we're talking about ideas like having common regional boundaries and so forth, which has been dismantled. not necessarily bad ideas. You know, remember there was a thesis behind all that. I was at OEO, and OEO was the cutting edge of the Ash Council proposal. There was a belief, and I believe it's accurate, that when you had 1,700 narrow categorical grants, which is what we had in 1969, remember OEO produced the book, that was the first step. How many do we have? We had some 1,700 or 2,100, depending on how you counted them. There was a lot. And most of these grants were going from the professional office in Washington almost directly to the person who was receiving it. And a symbiotic relationship develops between the recipient and the giver, in which the agency is the outsider, and in which they have a stake in maintaining that given grant program, irrespective of its value. And so the objective was to break that symbiotic relationship by creating politically accountable regional heads, in which all grant applications had to go through, in effect, you would make them with your regional office, where the region would say, would have the political decision on where to, who would get what, when the priorities are being made. Well, needless to say, the professional group saw this as an attack on them, particularly the educationists, and they said no to the proposal. And they really went after OEO and the Office of Education and the rest, because, I mean, education has been the primary benefit of these categorical grant programs. So there was a lot of significant theory that was behind what were proposals which would simply say we ought to have a common regional boundaries, and that would be the public level it was debated at, okay? But the real issue was something very much more subtle and very real, and people knew what was at stake. And it got beaten on that ground.
Bill Wemple.
How is it going to be possible, or is it, to do anything like what the Grace Commission, for instance, had laid out in what I thought was a very fine report, but it comes to grief because it will step on the feet of many congressional committee jurisdictions. Things can't be abolished.
Can give me an example of what Grace proposed?
I can't remember.
I remember
that was not very long ago and involved huge savings in the amount of money being poured out.
There's a reason why the Grace Commission basically was a failure. It started from a false set of presumptions. Its first presumption was that the government, the public sector, and private sector are alike and therefore should be governed by the same principles of management, and the public sector should, they even have a phrase in there, the public sector should be governed like a large corporation with control from the top down. It was dead before it began. Intellectually, it is false. That's a false presumption. Secondly, and I was there and very active in this whole thing, okay, this is a classic study of exactly how never to do a study and why American business is in bad shape. What Grace did is he got together, he phoned them up, 160 CEOs to send people to Washington. The net cost, according to Grace, was $75 million, they all stated at the Jockey Club. The first thing they found out is they couldn't live on government per diem, and therefore they didn't want to be an agency of the United States. So this is where I get involved. How can you have a private group have the right to access to all the records of the agencies of the United States? We had a hearing on the Hill. It was unconstitutional. They went ahead and did it anyway. It was a disaster. There wasn't a single person with government experience connected either. There was no public administrators. The staff, as I say, was at one time or another, ended up being 2,000 people coming and going, wash safe for a week, they make a report. They found out they couldn't do much. They ended up relying almost exclusively on previously done GAO reports. They produced 37 volumes, which line our walls, okay? They don't have an index, which makes it difficult to decide where things are. And then they produced one overall study with the provocative title of War on Waste. And then they argued for a variety of 2,486 specific recommendations, which went all from giant ones to the most mundane little ones. And they were very specific, and they said if you do X, Y, and Z, you will say that they came up with a figure of $3 trillion in the 1990s if everything was adopted. I mean, they wanted to turn the airports over to private people, for example. Now, let me say why that's not a sophisticated approach. There are aspects of any airport that should be done privately for a variety of reasons. But there are other aspects that are public law aspects. That is, they are elements of the sovereign and you cannot privatize them. For example, my right to arrest somebody or my right to enforce legally rigid safety standards is greatly different if I'm a public body or if I'm a private body. If you are part of the government of the United States, you know, the amendments to the Constitution, the Due Process Clause, only apply to officers and employees of the United States. It doesn't apply to private citizens. That's why we have an Administrative Procedures Act. When people say, like Grace says, I want to turn this all airports to the highest bidder, and then you say, well, should it come under the Administrative Procedures Act for the making of the rules? And they would say no, because it'll be private. We're having this problem with the Washington airport right now, where they made it half public and half private. And then they stuck on a board of congressmen who have the right to overrule the body, the decisions of this private body. Let me say, why is it private? It's private because it says it isn't responsible to the government. Ah, but the property is all owned by the FAA. And the bonds that they're letting all are doing something that those of us who consider to be unconstitutional. They're using public property as the collateral to back up these privately sold bonds, which means that the sovereign's power is being used as collateral. And we argue that you can't do that. And won in a court yet. But the Grace Commission was not, in my opinion, a sophisticated report, and therefore wasn't taken seriously and properly. The particular report that you're referring to was so bad. That is, they name names of evil congressmen who are fighting for bases in their district, and they name them by name. Well, I have it, I almost enshrined, okay? It was so bad that they got in a fight on the Grace Commission, and they had to go and they excised every name in it. And then they published it, so it's a lot of blank spaces. And then, of course, the Cato Commission came then put out the report with the names in it, you know, which you had to pay for. So the Grace Commission was not, in my opinion, this is obviously my opinion, Mr. Grace can argue for himself, but was not based on a conceptually sound understanding of the United States government, as was the Ash Council, and therefore was properly consigned to the dust heap.
One or two more questions, Carl, or?
I'm a little surprised at what you were saying about the Grace Commission, not because you were talking about the governmental structure or management organization, but the concept of efficiency. It seemed, in a little that I read from the Grace Commission, that they were trying to make a more efficient government.
Well.
And that's
well, nobody is opposed to efficiency. I mean, that word means a lot of different things. Okay, let me tell you, they proposed an Office of Federal Management, which I have proposed, okay? But they wanted in their Office of Federal Management all of OMB, all of GSA, all of OPM, and several other units from various things. They wanted a very large, 10,000 person, okay, highly centralized office that would make all the decisions, and that's how the president would run it. Because in their vision of the world, Congress, for example, and the laws play no role. Congress is not, and that's why Grace always was critical of Congress and why they all hated him, is that he, in his world, Congress was a nuisance, and the Constitution was a nuisance, and the laws were a nuisance. How can you run a good ship? He says, if you got these kibitzers over there in Congress who keep asking you these tough questions and get up and make you do things, well, I run my company differently. He said it just exactly like that in front of them. I'm not exaggerating one bit. And they looked at him and say, you know, this is a constitutional system, and you are this is to represent the people. You can't make private, decisions the way you do in a corporation, all of them being made downtown, and you can't ignore Congress. The truth of the matter is that Congress's oversight is frequently very good and very effective, and good administrators downtown, not only do they not fear a congressional oversight, they learn how to have a cooperative relationship that is very productive with the committees on the Hill. This is something Grace was totally opposed to. I mean, wonderful quotes by him on it. I mean, you know, the kinds of things that you can put in magazines.
Edith Mosher.
I noticed that you didn't give us any examples from the Defense Department or Pentagon management. Right now, the Pentagon is engaged in its largest operation in a long time. And according to what we read in the paper and see on television, it's proceeding efficiently. At the same time, we don't have any independent observations since the press is being kept away. And we do have background information to the effect that the Pentagon has been subject to some of the same third-party government and other management practices. How do we stand with regard to the
good and bad? Remember, that's right, the Defense Department is a command operation in a way other departments are, okay? And the culture of the Defense Department is correctly in a military culture, and therefore it doesn't fit neatly in many of the generalizations. However, you can say, a lot of people say it's very poorly managed because it is so heavily reliant on third parties. I mean, the Navy's ship, they contract out for ships, which makes it difficult when the people want to take their weekends off or take their leave. Many people argue that the Defense Department becomes a captive of the contractors because they have to keep them profitable so that when they need them, they can call upon them. This has been a very big problem. In that sense, management by third parties has not been taught well, and the Defense Department doesn't really do a spectacular job in this regard. But getting troops from here to Arabia, which I view, if you told me we could do this, I would have said we couldn't. I really think, if you really want to know the secret, has been the Secretary of Defense. I mean, as my little watching a television, he actually knows what he's doing and where everything is, and we couldn't say that about many Secretaries of Defense. That doesn't mean that it couldn't have been done without a good Secretary of Defense, but I doubt whether, in this case, I think it's a heavy dose of the right person at the right place. But the Defense Department is a management problem all of its own. I mean, you know, it's got third-party management and extremists for its procurement. That isn't necessarily bad. We don't want the government making everything. On the other hand, probably when you have contract out your supply ships to private corporations, or as my friend who had it said, it was kind of interesting. I had lunch with him on Tuesday night, and he was taking TWA, I guess it was, from San Francisco back here, and he went down there, and his plane had been changed. All TWA planes of a certain category were now been shifted to Arabia, and they said, we can't fly you, and he had to go to another airline. I mean, we are heavily dependent on the private sector in this regard. That's not necessarily bad. As you recall, the whole British Army was put on the QE2 to take the Falkland Islands, their only ship that they had to transport them. It's a modern world, but no.
One more question, two more. Wilson Newman and then Matt Aldridge.
Professor, I've been tremendously interested in some of your comments. I want to make one note. That's one question, but make a couple of comments first. I have known Ash Grace Commission made one mistake. It should have been headed by Peter Grace. It was a political assignment, not an economic one, and that's what I think what killed it. And Roy, I have nothing except that he has become more politicized over the years, which is the necessary ingredient to be effective, I think, in dealing with government. He had, as I've listened to your empirical commentary on the function of the administrative aspects of government, I thought to myself, all the world is trying to copy and wants to have a democracy like the United States. Would it have been discouraging for Mr. Gorbachev to sit in on our meeting this morning, considering what he's trying to do?
It would have been a good exercise for him to sit in on this. They have, they are here, you know, meeting people from all over the world. I mean, in many respects, France has a better system than we do. In other respects, it isn't as good. What you do is you kind of pick and choose. I spent 2 hours yesterday, and they were discussing the problem in Argentina and then Eastern Europe and the administration. And they have to develop really basic civil service. Their problem has been, like in Argentina, they have a very wilted central civil service, not paid. It has to exist solely on corruption. And then very expensive public enterprises outside in which the people are paid very well. Okay? Now they're trying to sell these public enterprises. And that's all of the crunch is coming. And then secondly, they're trying to get a civil service that is paid properly in the center, the guts of the whole operation, so that it can function as a modern state. And we're sitting here and watching the United States decline at the center with all the action going out the outside. See, all my friends are being picked off to work at Fannie Mae. I mean, the head of Fannie Mae makes $4.2 million a year. I mean, why would you work at Jenny Mae when you could work at Fannie Mae for five times the salary? So what you're seeing here is a situation in which if they come over to look at us, they should get a sophisticated report of what's going on. They shouldn't get the pap. I mean, I'm going to a conference next month in Hungary on constitution writing. Well, they've already made their mistake in their constitution. It's too late. What they did in their constitution is they had their legislature write it, and they incorporated in there everybody's idea of public policy in their constitution. It's 400 pages or something. And as everybody, it's really a list, whereas ours was kept short with only process questions. And that's why I'm opposed to all amendments to the Constitution, because I don't want people imposing their values that are public policy into a process document. But over there, they've already made their big mistake. They did not come over and learn from Mr. Madison how to write a Constitution for a new regime. They wrote it like our states write their Constitution. You know, you put in everything you can into it, because then no one can change it. So we got a lot of lessons to teach, but I'm afraid that most of the sessions with these people thus far have been pretty superficial, and only now are they beginning to get to the point where we're talking serious. I'll give you one there. CRS supports the members of Congress. It's like a large consulting agency. And almost all these countries are setting up CRS, because without a Congressional Research Service to support the members of their legislature, the legislators, without any staff, are really at a disadvantage against the executive branch. And so they're all setting up legislative services like ours. I mean, that part. And our people are there all the time, and there's constant detailed advising going on in that one area. It may be going on in certain other areas too that I'm not familiar with, but
final question, Knight Alders.
Mr. Moe, are there any potential managerial presidents on the horizon? Are there any senators, governors, generals, cabinet officers, or whatever that have the potential leadership to modify, to change the focus of the presidency in a more managerial direction?
My wife's very big, is active at that first level of politics, the partisan level. And I'm down on that third level where we have a hard time communicating. She said the surest way to lose for a person at the top would be the interest in my issues, okay? And they would say that although he was, that Dukakis thought he was interested in some third level issues, but he had difficulty articulating them. Do I see anybody on the horizon? My favorite person is Dick Cheney. He's the only person I know of that operates at all three levels. He's my favorite. If I had to pick, see, a great president is a president like Franklin Roosevelt or Dwight Eisenhower who operates at all three levels. Otherwise, you're only kind of good. And you can be really good at level one. I mean, George Bush, we are benefiting right now from George Bush's professional 25 years of knowing the world and knowing people. I mean, this has been just a masterstroke. Nobody else in the United States could have pulled this off, in my opinion. But he doesn't care about level three. I mean, he really doesn't care about it. And he says, I got elected for level one. I didn't get elected for level three. Let level three take care of itself. That's sort of the view. And so this way, a little bit of a cry in the wilderness, and I'm not cynical about it. We win little battles, and I'm basically an optimistic person. I mean, if I'd have sat here 5 years ago, I'm a free marketeer, and I would have said to you, outrageous as my comments have been, I teach by exaggeration, which you've probably figured out, but if I had said to you, which I would have said, that Russia will fall, I didn't think it would fall as quickly and as rapidly as it did. Because I do not believe that a command economy could long survive in a technologically integrated world, that Russia only had one choice, to be part of the future or not be part. I mean, you know, we were always worried about a lot of different things just 5 years ago. And yet, if you look at it, in retrospect, that was pretty obvious what was going on, actually. In retrospect, now you try to think, what is going to happen in the next 5 years? Well, that's why I'm a little pessimistic. And there are people like Cheney around, but in the Congress, I have found very few members, and that is really very discouraging. And none on the Government Operations Committee, which was created to be this committee. The committee that would be the counterpart for an Office of Federal Management downtown as a result of the first Hoover Commission in 49. None of them are interested or understand it. And it is very distressing in that sense.
Judge Souter said yesterday he wanted to be judged by, in the final analysis, by how he listened to what was said. We've had an opportunity to listen to a very clear and forceful, courageous presentation today. Some of you will remember at an earlier stage we also had a very forceful presentation by Peter Grace. So the Miller Center is at a point where we do have an opportunity to listen. And if the listening is always as good as it's been this morning, why, we'd be very happy indeed. We thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Cuomo isn't